Alienated Nation, the new quest for liberty. States United. I guess the revolution has arrived in Virginia, and I am delighted that I was here. It's very appropriate that the state of Virginia be involved in our revolution that's going on. Of course, our revolution is the American Revolution. We had a pretty good start in this country a few years back, but we drifted away, and for many years now, for nearly 100 years, I think there's been a lot of forgetting of what the original intent of the Constitution was. They have forgotten what a true republic is all about. That is our goal, to restore the American Republic to the American people. Ron Paul, 2008. While I was writing this book, I felt the surge of patriotism inside of me the Founding Fathers must have felt as they were considering the Declaration of Independence and arguing their way through the Articles of the Constitution. I could see their passion in the words, "We hold these truths to be self-evident." Aristotle once said that all knowledge is innate. That is to say, if you sat in meditation long enough about a certain subject, the truth will come to you from your own self. I think, as do billions of other sentient beings that have lived on this and other planets, that the higher self is intimately involved in these epiphanies. The definition of innate is inherent in the essential character of something, existing in one from birth. When Thomas Jefferson sat down, allegedly alone, to pen the Declaration of Independence, there were no crossouts. There were no erasures. There was no shadow of a mistake in that parchmented work of literature. Was this great knowledge innate within Mr. Jefferson? I think not. It is my belief that there was a design older than America. When Thomas Jefferson sat down, allegedly alone, to pen the Declaration of Independence, there were no crossouts. There were no erasures. There was no shadow of a mistake in that parchmented work of literature. Was this great knowledge innate within Mr. Jefferson? I think not. It is my belief there was a design, older than America will be in the next millennium, that was folded up in the soul of man himself. This design was a form of self-government that would allow the human race to reach the fullness of its potential using principles of the Republic he penned in that chamber. There is also evident another design that is perhaps even older. There is another design that is supported by the weak and unempowered masses. It was designed by beings whose desire is to lead sheep and not shepherds. It was designed to keep a few men soaking drunk in the wealth of others, while providing only enough to those dependents to keep them hoping for another few crumbs. There would be no dreaming. There would be no mechanism for self-reliance. The breadwinner would be completely replaced by their government, emasculating the males and effectively removing them from society. Once they are removed and obfuscated, they cannot threaten the leadership of the government, because the females would be completely addicted to the welfare state. In this form of agency government, there would be no available resource for an entrepreneur to be germinated. The driving force of the self-will of the individual to grow and to provide opportunity for self-employment for the many, without the aid of government, would be absolutely forbidden under this form of government. There is no possibility for freedom and liberty. This system of subterfuge has been built many times upon the earth, and perhaps on other worlds and in other times. The modus is to request that the people abdicate their liberty to the leaders in exchange for a promise of security. The people always happily comply. Some people still think there is such a thing as a free lunch. Unfortunately for democracies, these very same people are also voters who perpetuate the eradication of liberty. History has shown us that this system of government tends to stagnate. That is to say, the stream of commerce and opportunity is dammed up. Ideas and innovations that might compete against the interests of the federal government are denied access to capital. The population that makes up the pool of stagnating water begins to separate, like water and salad oil. What happens then is both extraordinary and predictable. The state tax revenue begins to drain to the federal government. States that do not have a federal interest lose money. States that have federal interests take in more money than they send to the federal government. This is precisely what happened and precipitated the war between the states. You may have never read this before. These are the words of South Carolina, making its case for secession from the Library of Congress. Quote, in the year 1765, that portion of the British Empire embracing Great Britain undertook to make laws for the government of that portion composed of the 13 American colonies. A struggle for the right of self-government ensued, which resulted on the 4th of July, 1776, in a declaration by the colonies that they are, and of right ought to be, free and independent states, and that as free and independent states they have full power to levy war, conclude peace, contract alliances, establish commerce, and to do all other acts and things which independent states may of right do. They further solemnly declared that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of the ends for which it was established, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it and to institute a new government. Deeming the government of Great Britain to have become destructive of these ends, they declared that the colonies are absolved from all allegiance to the British crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is, and ought to be, totally dissolved. In pursuance of this Declaration of Independence, each of the 13 states proceeded to exercise its separate sovereignty, adopted for itself a constitution, and appointed officers for the administration of government in all its departments, legislative, executive, and judicial. For purposes of defense, they united their arms and their councils, and in 1778 they entered into a league known as the Articles of Confederation, whereby they agreed to entrust the administration of their external relations to a common agent known as the Congress of the United States, expressly declaring in the first article that each state retains its sovereignty, freedom, and independence, and every power, jurisdiction, and right which is not by this confederation expressly delegated to the United States in Congress assembled. Mississippi had similar contemplations and a commitment to secession. These are words of passion. Some of the text of their statement refers to the practice of slavery. However, this is not the subject that I wish to address with this book, and is redacted to preserve the idea of states' rights while not enticing the prejudgment of the reader. Slavery is abhorrent in all its forms, whether to another human being or to subjugate him to the commands of debt for a lifetime without hope of deliverance. I quote, it, the federal government, has invaded a state and invested with the honors of martyrdom the wretch whose purpose was to apply flames to our dwellings and the weapons of destruction to our lives. It has broken every compact into which it has entered for our security. It is given indubitable evidence of its design to ruin our agriculture, to prostrate our industrial pursuits, and to destroy our social system. It knows no relenting or hesitation in its purposes. It stops not in its march of aggression, and it leaves us no room to hope for secession or for pause. It has recently obtained control of the government, and by the prosecution of its unhallowed schemes and destroyed the last expectation of living together in friendship and brotherhood. Utter subjugation awaits us in the Union. If we should consent longer to remain in it, it is not a matter of choice, but of necessity. We must either submit to degradation and to the loss of property worth $4 billion of money, or we must secede from the Union framed by our fathers to secure this as well as every other species of property. For far less cause than this, our fathers separated from the crown of England. Our decision is made. We follow their footsteps. We embrace the alternative of separation. And for the reasons here stated, we resolve to maintain our rights with the full consciousness of the justice of our course and the undoubting belief of our ability to maintain it. Georgia, whose state flag was once the flag of the capital of the Confederacy, made a factual case for secession as follows, and I quote, "The main reason was that the North, even if united, could not control both branches of the legislature during any portion of that time. Therefore, such an organization must have resulted either in utter failure or in the total overthrow of the government. The material prosperity of the North was greatly dependent on the federal government, that of the South not at all. In the first years of the Republic, the navigating, commercial, and manufacturing interests of the North began to seek profit and aggrandizement at the expense of the agricultural interests. Even the owners of fishing smacks sought and obtained bounties for pursuing their own business, which yet continue, and $500,000 is now paid them annually out of the treasury. The navigating interests begged for protection against foreign shipbuilders and against competition in the coastal trade. Congress granted both requests, and by prohibitory acts gave an absolute monopoly of this business to each of their interests, which they enjoy without dominion to this day. Congress granted both requests, and by prohibitory acts gave an absolute monopoly of this business to each of their interests, which they enjoy without diminution to this day. Not content with these great and unjust advantages, they have sought to throw the legitimate burden of their business as much as possible upon the public. They have succeeded in throwing the cost of lighthouses, buoys, and the maintenance of their seamen upon the treasury, and the government now pays above $2 million annually for the support of these objects. These interests in connection with the commercial and manufacturing classes have also succeeded, by means of subventions to mail steamers and the reduction in postage, in relieving their business from the payment of about $7 million annually, throwing it upon the public treasury under the name of postal deficiency. The manufacturing interests entered into the same struggle early and has clamored steadily for government bounties and special favors. This interest was confined mainly to the eastern and middle non-southern states. Wielding these great states, it held great power and influence, and its demands were in full proportion to its power. The manufacturers and miners wisely based their demands upon special facts and reasons rather than upon general principles, and thereby mollified much of the opposition of their opposing interests. They pleaded in their favor the infancy of their business in this country, the scarcity of labor and capital, the hostile legislation of other countries toward them, the great necessity of their fabrics in the time of war, and the necessity of high duties to pay the debt incurred in our war for independence. These reasons prevailed, and they received for many years enormous bounties by the general acquiescence of the whole country. But when these reasons ceased, they were no less clamorous for government protection. But their clamors were less heeded. The country had put the principle of protection upon trial and condemned it. After having enjoyed protection to the extent of from 15 to 200% upon their entire business for above 30 years, the Act of 1846 was passed. It avoided sudden change. But the principle was settled, and free trade, low duties, and economy and public expenditures was the verdict of the American people. The South and the Northwestern states sustained this policy, and there was but small hope of its reversal. Upon the direct issue, none at all. For 40 years, this question has been considered and debated in the halls of Congress, before the people, by the press, and before the tribunals of justice. The majority of the people of the North in 1860 decided it in their own favor. We refuse to submit to that judgment, and in vindication of our refusal, we offer the Constitution of our country and point to the total absence of any express power to exclude us. We offer the practice of our government for the first 30 years of existence in its complete refutation of the position that any such power is either necessary or proper to the execution of any other power in relation to the territories. We offer the judgment of a large minority of the people of the North, amounting to more than one-third, who, united with the unanimous voice of the South against this usurpation, and finally, we offer the judgment of the Supreme Court of the United States, the highest judicial tribunal of our country, in our favor. This evidence ought to be conclusive, that we have never surrendered this right. The conduct of our adversaries admonishes us that if we had surrendered it, it is time to resume it. The faithless conduct of our adversaries is not confined to such acts as might aggrandize themselves or their section of the Union. They are content if they can only injure us. The Constitution declares that persons charged with crimes in one state and fleeing to another shall be delivered up on the demand of the executive authority of the state from which they flee to be tried in the jurisdiction where the crime was committed. It would appear difficult to employ language freer from ambiguity. Yet, for above 20 years, the non-Southern states generally have wholly refused to deliver up to us persons charged with crimes affecting property. Our Confederates, with Punic faith, shield and give sanctuary to all criminals who seek to deprive us of this property or who use it to destroy us. This clause of the Constitution has no other sanction than their good faith. That is withheld from us. We are remediless in the Union. Out of it, we are remitted to the laws of nations. Texas was the only state not to sign the Reconstruction Agreements after the war was over, and resolved that it would secede from the Union as well. And I quote, "The government of the United States, by certain joint resolutions bearing date the first day of March, in the year 1845, proposed to the Republic of Texas, then a free, sovereign, and independent nation, the annexation of the latter to the former, as one of the co-equal states thereof. The people of Texas, by deputies in convention assembled on the fourth day of July of the same year, assented to and accepted said proposals and formed a constitution for the proposed state. Upon which, on the 29th day of December in the same year, said state was formally admitted into the Confederated Union. Texas abandoned her separate national existence and consented to become one of the Confederated Union to promote her welfare, ensure domestic tranquility, and secure more substantially the blessings of peace and liberty to her people. She was received into the Confederacy with her own constitution, under the guarantee of the federal constitution that the compact of the annexation, that she should enjoy these blessings. Her institutions and geographical position established the strongest ties between her and other southern states of the Confederacy. Those ties have been strengthened by association. But what has been the course of the government of the United States and of the people and authorities of the non-southern states since our connection with them? The controlling majority of the federal government, under various pretenses and disguises, has so administered the same as to exclude the citizens of the southern states, unless, under odious and unconstitutional restrictions, from all the immense territory owned in common by all the states on the Pacific Ocean, for the avowed purpose of acquiring sufficient power in the common government to use it as a means of destroying the institutions of Texas and her sister states. By the disloyalty of the northern states and their citizens, and the imbecility of the federal government, infamous combinations of incendiaries and outlaws have been permitted in those states and the common territory of Kansas to trample upon the federal laws, to war upon the lives and property of southern citizens in that territory, and finally, by violence and mob law, to usurp the possession of the same as exclusively the property of the northern states. The federal government, while but partially under the control of these our unnatural and sectional enemies, has for years almost entirely failed to protect the lives and property of the people of Texas against the Indian savages on our border, and more recently against the murderous forays of banditti from the neighboring territory of Mexico. And when our state government has expended large amounts for such purpose, the federal government has refused to reimburse, therefore, thus rendering our condition more insecure and harassing than it was during the existence of the Republic of Texas. These and other wrongs we have patiently borne in the vain hope that a returning sense of justice and humanity would induce a different course of administration. When we avert to the course of individual non-southern states, and that a majority of their citizens, our grievances assume far greater magnitude. The states of Maine, Vermont, New Hampshire, Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, New York, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Iowa, by solemn legislative enactments, have deliberately, directly or indirectly, violated the third clause of the second section of the fourth article of the federal constitution, and laws passed in pursuance thereof, thereby annulling a material provision of the compact, designed by its framers to perpetuate the amity between the members of the Confederacy and to secure the rights of the southern states in their domestic institutions. A provision founded in justice and wisdom, and without the enforcement of which the compact fails to accomplish the object of its creation. Some of those states have imposed high fines and degrading penalties upon any of their citizens or officers who may carry out in good faith that provision of the compact, or the federal laws enacted in accordance therewith. In all the non-southern states, in violation of that good faith and comity, which should exist between entirely distinct nations, the people have formed themselves into a great sectional party, now strong enough in numbers to control the affairs of each of those states. By consolidating their strength, they have placed the southern states in a homeless minority in the federal Congress and rendered representation of no avail in protecting southern rights against their exactions and encroachments. They have proclaimed, and at the ballot box sustained, the revolutionary doctrine that there is a higher law, that the Constitution and the laws of our federal union, and virtually that they will disregard their oaths and trample upon our rights. They have for years past encouraged and sustained lawless organizations to steal our property and prevent its recovery, and have repeatedly murdered Southern citizens while lawfully seeking their rendition. They have invaded Southern soil and murdered unoffending citizens, and through the press, their leading men and a fanatical pulpit have bestowed praise upon the actors and assassins in these crimes, while the governors of several of their states have refused to deliver parties implicated and indicted for participation in such offenses upon the legal demands of the states aggrieved. They have, through the mails and hired emissaries, sent seditious pamphlets and papers among us to stir up servile insurrection and bring blood and carnage to our firesides. They have sent hired emissaries among us to burn our towns and distribute arms to fuel their interests inside our community for the same purpose. They have impoverished the southern states by unequal and partial legislation, thereby enriching themselves by draining our substance. They have refused to vote appropriations for protecting Texas against ruthless savages for the sole reason that she is a southern state. And finally, by the combined sectional vote of the 17 non-southern states, they have elected as president and vice president of the whole Confederacy two men whose chief claims to such high positions are their approval of these long-continued wrongs and their pledges to continue them to the final consummation of these schemes for the ruin of the southern states. Close quote. As I stated earlier, the quotation has been altered by me to remove the references to slavery, as this is not the idea behind the motion to secede, and it is certainly not pertinent to the division of the states from the Union. The leaders of the Union made the case for war based upon the social issues of the day, while the economics of the entire debacle was not mentioned outside the pleadings of the southern states that were being taxed and levied with tariffs by a federal government spending like drunken sailors on every whim of the northern states. Finally, you must read the entire edited address of Robert Barnwell Rhett to the people assembled in convention of the southern states. This one state has led this nation into both of its revolutions. The past, the passion and power of its statesmen have inspired other nations around the world for over a century. You can close your eyes and hear the powerful and regal southern accent, as the oratory must have been such that within 3 years the action was taken to evict Union troops from all southern territory. Mr. Barnwell's address to South Carolina. Quote, "It is now 73 years since the union between the United States was made by the Constitution of the United States. During this period, their advance in wealth, prosperity, and power has been scarcely a parallel in the history of the world. The great object of their union was external defense from the aggressions of more powerful nations, now complete, from their more progress in power 31 millions of people, with a commerce and navigation which explores every sea, and of agricultural productions which are necessary to every civilized people. Command the friendship of the world. But unfortunately, our internal peace has not grown with our external prosperity. Discontent and contention has moved in the bosom of the Confederacy for the last 35 years. During this time, South Carolina has twice called her people together in solemn convention to take into consideration the aggressions and unconstitutional wrongs perpetrated by the people of the North on the people of the South. These wrongs were submitted to by the people of the South under the hope and expectation that they would be final. But these hopes and expectations have proved to be void. Instead of being incentives to forbearance, our submission has only instigated to new forms of aggression and outrage, and South Carolina, again assembling her people in convention, has this day dissolved her connection with the states constituting the United States. The one great evil from which all other evils have flowed is the overthrow of the Constitution of the United States. The government of the United States is no longer the government of a Confederate Republic, but of a consolidated democracy. It is no longer a free government, but a despotism. It is, in fact, such a government as Great Britain attempted to set over our fathers, and which was resisted and defeated by a 7 years' struggle for independence. The Revolution of 1776 turned upon one great principle: self-government and self-taxation, the criterion of self-government. Where the interests of two people united together under one government are different, each must have the power to protect its interests by the organization of the government, or they cannot be free. The interests of Great Britain and of the colonies were different and antagonistic. Great Britain was desirous of carrying out the policy of all nations toward their colonies, of making them tributary to their wealth and power. She had vast and complicated relations with the whole world. Her policy toward her North American colonies was to identify them with her in all these complicated relations and to make them bear, in common with the rest of the empire, the full burden of her obligations and necessities. She had a vast public debt. She had a European policy and an Asiatic policy, which had occasioned the accumulation of her public debt and which kept her in continual wars. The North American colonies saw their interests, political and commercial, sacrificed by such a policy. Their interests required that they should not be identified with the burdens and wars of the mother country. They had been settled under the charters which gave them self-government, at least so far as the property was concerned. They had taxed themselves and had never been taxed by the government of Great Britain. To make them a part of a consolidated empire, the Parliament of Great Britain determined to assume the power of legislating for the colonies in all cases whatsoever. Our ancestors resisted the pretension. They refused to be a part of the consolidated government of Great Britain. The southern states now stand exactly in the same position toward the northern states that our ancestors and the colonies did toward Great Britain. The northern states, having the majority in Congress, claim the same power of omnipotence in legislation as the British Parliament. The, quote, general welfare, close quote, is the only limit to the legislation of either, and the majority in Congress, as in the British Parliament, are the sole judges of the expediency of the legislation this general welfare requires. Thus, the government of the United States has become a consolidated government, and the people of the southern states are compelled to meet the very despotism their father threw off in the Revolution of 1776. The consolidation of the government of Great Britain over the colonies was attempted to be carried out by the taxes. The British Parliament undertook to tax the colonies to promote British interests. Our fathers resisted this pretension. They claimed the right of self-taxation through the colonial legislatures. They were not represented in the British Parliament, and therefore could not rightfully be taxed by its legislature. The British government, however, offered them a representation in the British Parliament, but it was not sufficient to enable them to protect themselves from the majority, and they refused it. Between taxation without any representation and taxation without a representation adequate to protection, there was no difference. By neither would the colonies tax themselves. Hence, they refused to pay the taxes paid by the British Parliament. The southern states now stand in the same relation toward the northern states in the vital manner of taxation that our ancestors stood toward the people of Great Britain. They are in a minority in Congress. Their representation in Congress is useless to protect them against unjust taxation. And they are taxed by the people of the North for their benefit, exactly as the people of Great Britain taxed our ancestors in the British Parliament for their benefit. For the last 40 years, the taxes laid by the Congress of the United States have been laid with a view of subserving the interests of the North. The people of the South have been taxed by duties on imports, not for revenue, but for an object inconsistent with revenue, to promote, by prohibitions, Northern interests in the productions of their mines and manufactures. There is another evil in the condition of the Southern toward the Northern states, which our ancestors refused to bear toward Great Britain. Our ancestors not only taxed themselves, but all the taxes collected from them were expended among them. Had they submitted to the pretensions of the British government, the taxes collected from them would have been expended on other parts of the British Empire. They were fully aware of the effect of such a policy in impoverishing the people from whom the taxes are collected, and in enriching those who receive the benefit of their expenditure. To prevent the evils of such a policy was one of the motives which drove them on to revolution. Yet this British policy has been fully realized toward the southern states by the northern states. The people of the southern states are not only taxed for the benefit of the northern states, but after the taxes are collected, 3/4 of them are expended at the north. This cause, with others connected with the operation of the general government, has provincialized the cities of the south. Their growth is paralyzed, while they are the mere suburbs of northern cities. The basis of foreign commerce of the United States are the agricultural productions of the South, yet southern cities do not carry it on. Our foreign trade is almost annihilated. In 1740, there were 5 shipyards in South Carolina to build ships to carry on our direct trade with Europe. Between 1740 and 1779, there were built in these shipyards 25 square-rigged vessels, beside a great number of sloops and schooners to carry on our coast and West India trade. In the half-century immediately preceding the Revolution, from 1725 to 1775, the population of South Carolina increased 7-fold. No man can for a moment believe that our ancestors intended to establish over their posterity exactly the same sort of government they had overthrown. The great object of the Constitution of the United States in its internal operation was doubtless to secure the great end of the Revolution, a limited free government, a government limited to those matters only which were general and common to all portions of the United States. All sectional and local interests were to be left to the states. By no other arrangement would they obtain free government by a constitution common to so vast a confederacy. Yet, by gradual and steady encroachments on the part of the North and submissions on the part of the South, the limitations in the Constitution have been swept away, and the government of the United States has become consolidated with a claim of limitless power. in its operations. It is not at all surprising, while such is the character of the government of the United States, that it should assume to possess power over all the institutions of the country. The agitations on the subject of slavery in the South are the natural results of the consolidation of the government. Responsibility follows power. And if the people of the North have the power by Congress to promote the general welfare of the United States by any means they deem expedient, why should they not assail and overthrow the institution of slavery in the South? They are responsible for its continuance or existence in proportion to their power. A majority in Congress, according to their interested and perverted views, is omnipotent. The inducements to act upon the subject of slavery under such circumstances were so imperious as to amount almost to a moral necessity. To make, however, their numerical power available to the rule the Union, the North must consolidate their power. It would not be united on any matter common to the whole Union, in other words, on any constitutional subject, for on such subjects divisions are as likely to exist in the North as in the South. Slavery was strictly a sectional interest. If this could be made the criterion of parties at the North could be united in its power and thus carry out its measures of sectional ambition, encroachment, and aggrandizement to build up their sectional predominance in the Union. The Constitution must first be abolished by constructions. But that being done, the consolidation of the North to rule the South by the tariff and slavery issues was in the obvious course of things. The Constitution of the United States was an experiment. The experiment consisted in uniting under one government different peoples, living in different climates, and having different pursuits of industry and institutions. It matters not how carefully the limitations of such a government are laid down in the Constitution. Its success must at least depend upon the good faith of the parties to the constitutional compact in enforcing them. It is not in the power of human language to exclude false inferences, constructions, and perversions in any constitution. And when vast sectional interests are to be subserved, involving the appropriation of countless millions of money, it has not been the usual experience of mankind that words on parchment can arrest power. The Constitution of the United States, irrespective of the interposition of the states, rested on the assumption that power would yield to faith, that integrity would be stronger than interest, and that thus the limitations of the Constitution would be observed. The experiment has been fairly made. The Southern states, from the commencement of the government, have striven to keep it within the orbit prescribed by the Constitution. The experiment has also failed. The whole Constitution, by the constructions of the Northern people, has been swallowed up by a few words in its preamble. In their reckless lust for power, they seem unable to comprehend that seeming paradox, that the more power is given to the general government, the weaker it becomes. Its strength consists in its generality and limitations. To extend the scope of its power over sectional or local interests is to raise up against it opposition and resistance. In all such matters, the general government must necessarily be a despotism, because all sectional or local interests must ever be represented by a minority in the councils of the general government, having no power to protect itself against the rule of the majority. The majority, constituted from those who do not represent these sectional or local interests, will control and govern them. A free people cannot submit to such a government, and the more it enlarges the sphere of its power, the greater must be the dissatisfaction it must produce, and the weaker it must become. On the contrary, the more it abstains from usurped powers, and the more faithfully it adheres to the limitations of the Constitution, the stronger it is made. The Northern people have had neither the wisdom nor the faith to perceive that to observe the limitation of the Constitution was the only way to its perpetuity. Under such a government, there must be, of course, many and endless irrepressible conflicts between the two great sections of the Union. The same faithlessness which has abolished the Constitution of the United States will not fail to carry out the sectional purposes for which it has been abolished. There must be conflict, and the weaker section of the Union can only find peace and liberty in an independence of the North. The repeated efforts made by the South, by South Carolina, in a wise conservatism, to arrest the progress of the general government in its fatal progress to consolidation, have been unsupported and denounced as faithless to the objections of the Constitution by the very men and states who were destroying it by their usurpations. It is now too late to reform or restore the government of the United States. All confidence in the North is lost in the South. The faithlessness of half a century has opened a gulf of separation between them which no promises or engagements can fulfill. It cannot be believed that our ancestors would have assented to any union, whatever, with the people of the North if the feelings and opinions now existing among them had existed when the Constitution was framed. There was then no tariff. It was the delegates from New England who proposed in the Constitution, which framed the Constitution to the delegates from South Carolina and Georgia, that if they would agree to give Congress the power of regulating commerce by a majority, that they would support the extension of the Southern foreign trade for 20 years. Foreign trade existed in all the states but one. The idea that they would be made to pay that tribute to their Northern Confederates, which they had refused to pay to Great Britain, or that the institution of foreign trade would be made the grand basis of a sectional organization of the North to rule the South, never crossed their imaginations. They were guilty of no such folly. Time and the progress of things have totally altered the relations between the Northern and Southern states since the Union was first established. That identity of feeling, interests, and institutions which once existed is gone. They are now divided between agricultural and manufacturing and commercial states, between Southern and Northern states. Their institutions and industrial pursuits have made them totally different peoples. That equality in the government between the two sections of the Union which once existed no longer exists. We but imitate the policy of our fathers in dissolving a union with Northern Confederates and seeking a confederation with Southern states. Experience has proven that Southern states cannot be safe in subjection to Northern states. Indeed, no people ever expect to preserve their rights and liberties unless they are in their own custody. To plunder and oppress, where plunder and oppression can be practiced with impunity, seems to be the natural order of things. The fairest portion of the world have been turned into wildernesses, and the most civilized and prosperous communities have been impoverished and ruined by fanaticism. The people of the North have not left us in doubt as to their designs and policy. United as a section in the late presidential election, they have elected as the exponent of their policy one who has openly declared that all the states of the United States must be subjected to the rule of the Union. And when it is considered that the Northern states will soon have the power to make the Supreme Court what they please, and that the Constitution has never been any barrier whatever in their exercise of power, what check can there be in the unrestrained councils of the North? There is sympathy in association, which carries men along without principle. But when there is principle, and that principle is fortified by long-existing prejudices and feelings. Association is omnipotent in party influences. The hypocrisy of 30 years, the faithlessness of their whole course from the commencement of our union with them, show that the people of the North are not and cannot be safe associates of the South under a common government. Not only their fanaticism, but their erroneous views of the principles of free governments render it doubtful whether, separated from the South, they can maintain a free government among themselves. Brute numbers with them is the great element of free government. A majority is infallible and omnipotent. The right divine to rule in kings is only transferred to their majority. The very object of all constitutions in free popular governments is to restrain the majority. Constitutions, therefore, according to their theory, must be most unrighteous inventions restricting liberty. None ought to exist, but the body politic ought simply to have a political organization to bring out and enforce the will of a majority. This theory may be harmless in a small community having an identity of interests and pursuits, but over a vast state, still more over a vast confederacy, having various and conflicting interests and pursuits, it is a remorseless despotism. In resisting it, as applicable to ourselves, we are vindicating the great cause of free government, more important perhaps to the world than the existence of the United States. Nor in resisting it do we intend to depart from the safe instrumentality the system of government we have established with them requires. In separating from them, we invade no rights, no interest of theirs. We violate no obligation of duty to them. As separate, independent states in convention, we made the Constitution of the United States with them. And as separate, independent states, each state acting for itself, we adopted it. South Carolina, acting in her sovereign capacity, now thinks proper to secede from the Union. She did not part with her sovereignty in adopting the Constitution. The last thing a state can be presumed to have surrendered is her sovereignty. Her sovereignty is her life. Nothing but a clear, express grant can alienate it. Inference should be dumb, yet it is not at all surprising that those who have construed away all the limitations of the Constitution should also, by construction, claim the annihilation of the sovereignty of the states, having abolished all barriers to their omnipotence by their faithless constructions in the operations of the general government. It is most natural that they should endeavor to do the same toward us in the states. The truth is, they have violated the express provisions of the Constitution. It is at an end as a compact. It is morally obligatory only on those who choose to accept its perverted terms. South Carolina, deeming the compact not only violated in particular features, but virtually abolished by her northern confederates, withdraws herself as a party from its obligations. The right to do so is denied by her northern confederates. They desire to establish a despotism, not only omnipotent in Congress, but omnipotent over the states. And as if to manifest the imperious necessity of our secession, they threaten us with the sword to coerce submission to their rule. Citizens of the southern states of the United States, circumstances beyond our control have placed us in the van of the great controversy between the northern and southern states. We would have preferred that other states should have assumed the position we now occupy. Independent ourselves, we disclaim any design or desire to lead the councils of other southern states. Providence has cast our lot together by extending over us an identity of pursuits, interests, and institutions. South Carolina desires no destiny separated from yours. To be one of a great confederacy, stretching its arms over a territory larger than any power in Europe possesses, with population 4 times greater than that of the whole United States when they achieved their independence of the British Empire, with productions which make our existence more important to the world than that of any other people inhabiting it, with common institutions to defend and common dangers to encounter, we ask your sympathy and confederation. While constituting a portion of the United States, it has been your statesmanship which has guided it in its mighty strides to power and expansion. In the field, as in the cabinet, you have led the way to its renown and grandeur. You have loved the Union, in whose service your great statesmen have labored, and your great soldiers have fought and conquered, not for the material benefits it conferred, but with the faith of a generous and devoted chivalry. You have long lingered and hoped over the shattered remains of a broken constitution. Compromise after compromise, formed by your concessions, has been trampled underfoot by your northern confederates. All fraternity of feeling between the North and the South is lost, or has been converted into hate. And we of the South are at last driven together by the stern destiny which controls the existence of nations. Your bitter experience of the faithlessness and rapacity of your northern confederates may have been necessary to evolve those great principles of free government upon which the liberties of the world depend, and to prepare you for the grand mission of vindicating and reestablishing them. We rejoice that other nations should be satisfied with their institutions. Self-complacency is a great element of happiness with nations as with individuals. We are satisfied with ours. If they prefer a system of industry in which capital and labor are in perpetual conflict, and chronic starvation keeps down the natural increase of population, and man is worked out in 8 years, and the law ordains that children shall be worked only 10 hours a day, and the saber and bayonet are the instruments of order, be it so. It is their affair, not ours. We prefer, however, our system of industry, by which labor and capital are identified in interest, and capital therefore protects labor, by which our population doubles every 20 years, by which starvation is unknown and abundance crowns the land, by which order is preserved by unpaid police, and the most fertile regions of the world where the Caucasian cannot labor are brought into usefulness by the labor of our own people, and the whole world is blessed by our own productions. We all demand of other peoples, all we demand of other peoples is to be let alone to work out our own high destinies, united together, and we must be the most independent, as we are the most important among the nations of the world. United together, and we require no other instruments to conquer peace than our beneficent productions. United together, and we must be a great, free, and prosperous people, whose renown must spread throughout the civilized world and pass down, we trust, to the remotest ages. We ask you to join us in forming a confederacy of southern states. Close quote. The reason I include these powerful words, which have been edited by me, to highlight the emphasis on South Carolina's correlation of undue influence on the federal government to Great Britain's treatment of the original colonies, is that when an all-powerful federal agency government can coerce free enterprise to comply with regulations and to submit fees and pay fines to unwillingly supply funding to those same oppressive inner agencies, there is an equal and opposite government that will rise against that government. That rising government will not be harmonious. That rising government will be elected and will represent the citizens of the state and local communities. The state legislatures are close to the local people and are more facilitated by the will of Main Street as opposed to Wall Street. Serving in the state capitol is not even close to the culture of Washington. There are far fewer cameras and no compunction of custom in the states to allow dynasties to crystallize from apathy. Virtue is gained by many acts and lost by only one on a state level. Not so in Washington. Apparently, one simply has to refuse to resign in order to keep the office of a U.S. congressman or a senator. The states are alone in their plight in the year 2012. Each state must declare on its own to declare sovereignty. A sovereign state, or simply state, is classically defined as a state with a defined territory on which it exercises internal and external sovereignty, a permanent population, a government, and the capacity to enter into relations with other sovereign states. It is also normally understood to be a state which is neither dependent on nor subject to any other power or state. As of the writing of this book, there are 40 states who have either passed or debated sovereignty acts. It took 2 years for the state of North Carolina to do so. It was finally passed on February 11, 2011, and the resolution reads as follows. This is H31. A House resolution supporting the state of North Carolina's right to claim sovereignty over certain powers under the 10th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States. And I quote, whereas the 10th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States reads as follows, the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states, respectively, or to the people, and whereas the 10th Amendment defines the total scope of federal power as being that specifically granted by the Constitution of the United States and no more, and whereas the scope of power defined by the 10th Amendment means that the federal government was created by the states specifically to be an agent of the states, and whereas today, in 2011, the states are demonstrably treated as agents of the federal government, and whereas many federal mandates are directly in violation of the 10th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States, and whereas Section 4 of Article 4 of the Constitution of the United States says, the United States shall guarantee to every state in this union a republican form of government. And the 9th Amendment states that the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. And whereas the United States Supreme Court ruled in New York versus United States in 1992 that Congress may not simply commandeer the legislative and regulatory processes of the states. And whereas a number of proposals from previous administrations and some now pending from the present administration and from Congress may further violate the Constitution of the United States, now therefore be it resolved by the House of Representatives. Section 1. The North Carolina House of Representatives supports the state's right to claim sovereignty under the 10th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States over all powers not otherwise enumerated and granted to the federal government or reserved to the people by the Constitution of the United States. Section 2. The North Carolina House of Representatives urges the federal government, as the agent of the state, to cease and desist, effective immediately, mandates that are beyond the scope of any constitutionally delegated powers. And Section 3. The North Carolina House of Representatives further urges that compulsory federal legislation which directs states to comply under threat of civil or criminal penalties or sanctions or requires states to pass legislation or lose federal funding be prohibited or repealed. Close quote. Utah had a rather mundane 2012 state legislative session, with the exception of the state sovereignty bill. Most people do not know that Since its admission into the Union, the federal government has owned more than 70% of its state land. President Clinton declared 1 million more acres, which happened to have prime Lowell sulfur coal deposits, off limits to state enterprise, left with nothing much more than salt and red rocks. The legislators are finally acting to reclaim their state from the federal agency government. Here is what was published in the Salt Lake Tribune, and I quote, "In the $13 billion budget, which saw about $440 million in new spending, lawmakers were good to education, law enforcement, state employees, and social services. But it was the state sovereignty palooza, including Utah's Sagebrush Rebellion 2.0, that garnered the most attention as lawmakers sought to stake a claim to 30 million acres of federal land in the state with an eye toward instigating a court fight. Conservative Republicans also waged a war over educational curriculum standards Utah and other states joined, which they viewed as a federal power grab. And the legislature joined a health care compact with four other states, asking the federal government to cede health care programs to the state. Quote, a message has been sent. That's part of why we're doing it. But we sent a message last year, and we sent a message almost every year, said Senate President Michael Wattups, a Republican from Taylorsville. He goes on to say, I think the weight of the message is starting to build, though. Wattups said he hears similar frustrations from his colleagues in places like Idaho, Arizona, Ohio, and other states. He goes on to say, we're joining the cacophony of sounds that is coming from the legislatures around this country saying, Washington, enough is enough. Close quote. But making a statement is very different from making a change, points out Thad Hall, a political science professor at University of Utah. The bills the legislators passed, whether demanding the federal government surrender lands in the state or give up running health care, all require Congress to act. Failing that, they don't accomplish much. It was a weak bluff. But the fact that legislators stood up to the federal agency government and told them, this is our land, sounds a little bit like Jake Sully telling the Na'vi people to declare their sovereignty as a united body against the imperial mercenaries sent by corporate Earth to exploit the rare and powerful element unobtainium in the movie Avatar. Utah seeks to earn a place before the Supreme Court in reclaiming their lands. Other states hope to do the same thing on the subjects of health care, road maintenance, education, and other state functions that have been summarily seized by the agency government. The states are hoping for a nice, clean, legal struggle. It will make for a nice re-election campaign item. I'm getting the feeling, as I hear the speeches and see the spirit of secession behind the letters of the words in these various declarative acts, that there will be a standoff between the state militias, now under the complete control of the Secretary of Defense, and the federal armies. The uniforms look identical, but the patches on the shoulders will be quite different. The mystery is whether the hearts beating next to those gun stocks will break for liberty moments before pulling that first trigger. There was a quote that was thrown around in the 1960s when people were beginning to protest the Vietnam War, which really wasn't a war, according to Ron Paul. The quote was this, what if they threw a war and nobody came? Well, it sounds good. It sounds so good that I wanted to know the true source of the quote. It is always good to consider great thoughts in context. Here is the entire poem by Bertolt Brecht, written in the 1930s. Quote, what if they gave a war and nobody came? Why, then, the war would come to you. He who stays home when the fight begins and lets another fight for his cause should take care. He who does not take part in the battle will share in the defeat. Even avoiding battle will not avoid battle, since not to fight for your own cause really means fighting on behalf of your enemy's cause. Close quote. That is really a compressed statement against apathy. To vegetate with your smartphone in your lap will be the same as throwing your fist into the air and screaming the oppressor's dehumanizing chant. To smile in a dope-induced stupor and claim you have no idea who is vice president, or to vote for the politician who promises to make rich corporate folks pay your rent payments, is the same as dive-bombing streets full of peaceful protesters. The states are sovereign entities that have a federal arrangement that simply allows them to drive across the next border. It allows someone in Indianapolis to sell a car on eBay to someone in Arkansas. It allows your driver's license to be valid from state to state. It does not mean that the Environmental Protection Agency can pass a regulation with the force of law that shuts down the construction of a new coal-fired power plant that the government has funded and approved. There are two things that unite states to work together. The first is commerce. The second is an assault by the federal agency government upon state legal activities conducted on or private properties. There are two things that unite states to work together. The first is commerce. The second is an assault by the federal agency government upon state legal activities conducted on private properties owned by state residents. One state cannot stand against the secretaries of the president. History has shown us that it will take more than 13 states to do so. As of the writing of this book, it is evident that at least 40 states have declared their sovereignty. Now, what will it take to mount a defense that can hold the line against the agency government led by the executive branch? Since I am writing this book, I choose not to consider violence of any kind. Even passive protests will put people in the way of the agency government troops. You will suffer chemical spray, severe beatings with clubs, or have your teeth broken by having your head stomped by steel-toed boots, or you will have your picture taken. Even if no one touches you in any way, your picture and identity will be added to an international database of potentially violent enemies of the agency government. You may never be able to fly as a passenger on an airline again. You may never be able to qualify for any government aid of any kind. Thousands of Tea Party members are being audited or closely reviewed by the IRS and other government agencies this year alone. I would therefore suggest that you do not join any march against any agency. It does not work in this country anymore. There is no possible way that any type of election can change anything. Representatives of the Republic have no power to even get any agency to answer a single question. In fact, it is illegal for a congressman or a senator to even speak to an agency about a constituent's application to do business with the government through that agency. There is only one thing that the states are empowered to do by the Constitution. It is the single most powerful tool at their disposal. There is no defense against it. It is 100% effective, and it has been used only 17 times since the first document was narrowly ratified on June 21st, 1788. The procedure is called a constitutional convention. This process is so powerful and so unpredictable, as designed by the Constitution itself, that if it is not handled carefully, it could result in the complete destruction of America. Still, it is the only weapon that will save the Republic. The agency government has become so powerful that it can circumvent Congress and attack the states directly, using the full power of the federal executive branch. No state can withstand such a massive display of power. They command troops, judges, soldiers, and scores of financial agents who can seize wealth within seconds and bring an entire state to a standstill in a matter of hours. There are loud and generally annoying calls for a constitutional convention to be held on July 4th, 2012 in Philadelphia. Although I applaud the amateur left jab at statesmanship, this display of gauche opportunism gives most people a rash. The governors of each state, with a fully ratified sovereignty act on their books, can appoint an Athenian delegation made of an equal number of delegates from each state. There can be one or two or 20, but the larger the number, the greater the temptation of a cacophonous debate collapsing into a brawl. There must be a clear and concise set of amendments to the Constitution drafted. The precision and accuracy of the language can be completed and approved ahead of the convention. There is a strong suggestion to repeal several amendments that have served their purpose and are no longer necessary. The following is a list of amendments that must be repealed in order for the Republic to survive and prosper. This is a call to action to repeal the following amendments of the Constitution. The 16th Amendment, passed by Congress on the 2nd of July, 1909, ratified the 3rd of February, 1913. These are the words of the amendment that needs to be repealed. The Constitution shall have power to lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever source derived, without apportionment among the several states and without regard to any census or enumeration. The second amendment to be repealed is the 17th Amendment, passed by Congress on the 13th of May, 1912, ratified on the 8th of April, 1913. These are the words of the amendment that needs to be repealed. The Senate of the United States shall be composed of two senators from each state, elected by the people thereof for 6 years, and each senator shall have one vote. The electors in each state shall have the qualifications requisite for electors of the most numerous branch of the state legislatures. When vacancies happen in the representation of any state in the Senate, the executive authority of such state shall issue writs of election to fill such vacancies, provided that the legislature of any state may empower the executive thereof to make temporary appointments until the people fill the vacancies by election, as the legislatures may direct. This amendment shall not be so construed as to affect the election or term of any senator chosen before it becomes valid as part of the Constitution. The third and final amendment to be repealed is the 27th Amendment, passed by Congress on the 25th of September, 1789, ratified on the 7th of May, 1992. No law varying the compensation for the services of the senators and representatives shall take effect until an election of representatives shall have intervened. That's pretty simple, isn't it? Three amendments that need to be repealed. That's all. Now, there is still some work to do. I have served in management of several corporations and financial ventures. You may have as well. There is one thing that we all know. No company can remain in business if it continues to spend more than it earns. Even the federal government is bound by this simple rule of economics. As of the writing of this book, Europe is about $100 trillion in debt, and the entire economy totals to about $70 trillion. Even a child can see there is no possible way the math can work out. Europe is doomed to fail as a union of country states. The jury does not need to come in on this one. Greece, Spain, Italy have collapsed, and France, Belgium, and perhaps others will fall as well. The people have simply voted for themselves so much of the state's revenue that there is not enough to even keep the banks solvent. There is still time to fix America, but not much. We have about 24 months before complete collapse of the dollar. The entire business finance world has been corrupted and must be repaired. Remember, the focus is the agency government coup d'etat that took your liberties away. This is what needs to be fixed, and there is only one other way besides the one I am proposing with this book. That other way is the subject of someone else's book, not this one. We can do this the constitutional way. Here we go. This is a call to action. Amendments to be passed and ratified at the Constitutional Convention. It's true. The following amendments can be drafted, approved on the state level, passed in the convention, and ratified by a two-thirds majority all in one day. The entire process can be completed without any problems whatsoever. Here is the first amendment that needs to be passed and ratified by the Constitutional Convention. The 28th Amendment. No agency, department, or bureau shall exist under the federal government, nor will the regulations created by them have any force of law in any state where that regulation is not ratified by the state legislature. Congress shall represent the citizens of their sovereign states and shall govern the agencies, departments, administrations, and bureaus. Further, the legislative branch shall have the sole purview and accountability over the agencies, departments, administrations, and bureaus. The 29th Amendment. The President shall have a cabinet of advisors serving at his will, none of whom can officiate in any capacity in any agency, department, administration, or bureau. These individuals shall be barred from private or public service with any agency, department, administration, or bureau conducting business for or with the federal government for a period of no less than 5 years. During their service, they shall further be barred from holding any ownership, options, or promise of ownership in any publicly traded company or in any company that becomes publicly traded for a period of 5 years after their service in the executive cabinet. The 30th Amendment. The Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes on any transaction of commerce wherein currency is the form of trade. The rate shall be uniform for all commerce conducted in the several states without exemption. The tax shall be collected at the point of sale and rendered unto the United States Treasury no more than 30 days from the day of the transaction. Congress shall not have the power to lay and collect taxes from income or profits. The 31st Amendment. The Senate of the United States shall be composed of 2 senators from each state, elected by the people thereof for 6 years, and each senator shall have 1 vote. No senator shall serve more than 3 terms, either consecutively or cumulatively. The electors in each state shall have the qualifications requisite for electors of the most numerous branch of the state legislatures. When vacancies happen in the representation of any state in the Senate, the executive authority of such state shall issue writs of election to fill such vacancies, provided that the legislature of any state may empower the executive thereof to make temporary appointments until the people fill the vacancies by election, as a legislature may direct. This amendment shall not be so construed as to affect the election or term of any senator chosen before it becomes valid as a part of the Constitution. The 32nd Amendment. The Congress of the United States shall be composed by proportion to represent each state, elected by the people thereof, for 4 years, and each congressman shall have 1 vote. No congressman shall serve for more than 3 terms, either consecutively or cumulatively. The electors in each state shall have the qualifications requisite for electors of the most numerous branch of the state legislatures. When vacancies occur in the representation of any state in the Congress, the executive authority of such state shall issue writs of election to fill such vacancies, provided that the legislature of any state may empower the executive thereof to make temporary appointments until the people fill the vacancies by elections as the legislature may direct. This amendment shall not be so construed as to affect the election or term of any congressman chosen before it becomes valid as part of the Constitution. The 33rd Amendment. The President shall have the authority to review any bill sent for his signature and to veto any portion of that bill. He shall report the line items vetoed to the American people, unless the reporting of such items shall harm the security of the United States. The 34th Amendment. The United States shall have command of their own militias and their National Guards. No state shall be compelled to conscribe its militia or its National Guard, but shall be free to choose service by its own consensus and sovereignty. Now, this is not an exhaustive list of amendments. There are numerous acts in the chapter Sovereignty in this book that can address the other powerful issues of our republic. Some of these issues may be resolved with legislation, but the above listed items must be done by amendment, as they then cannot be undone by wealth or corruption. Each of these amendments is powerful, but together they will prevent the imbalance of powers that we see today. The executive branch has become the monarchy that the founding fathers feared most. The unfunded mandates of the president's ministers have led us to ruin and devastation. The congressional dynasties that perpetuate oppression upon the states can be ended forever only by passing all of the amendments listed above. If we leave any of these out of the set, the balance of power is upset and tyranny will continue.